Blog Talk Radio.
Forgotten that I did that, so I apologize for starting late. I can't believe there are three people who stuck with it, and for you, we're going to do a show, a brief show, and I encourage you to hit one if you want to talk. I think the dominant political issue is still Syria, even though we spent a lot of time talking about that last week. I am glad that the president has decided to seek approval from Congress. I believe that's what it says in the Constitution, for one thing. But also, I think that it could set a new precedent so that future wars are declared by Congress. I think there was wisdom in that stipulation in the Constitution. And certainly, as we have slipped into the president is the decider, or whoever controls the president, as we saw in the previous administration, is the decider. There was some danger in that. Not only wars for the wrong reason, but wars for profit, wars for vendetta, wars for any reason other than national defense are bad. And you get into some gray area with Syria. Because we're talking about people far away who were not only recently hit with chemical weapons, but have been massacred by their government over the past couple years. There's a lot of talk about the sort of the shadow of Iraq, the haunting of the American people, the mistakes we made, the WMD, the faulty intelligence, the lies, and of course all the carnage, the death, the displacement, the loss of our country's national reputation or standing, and that's all true. But you know, there's another hangover that is sort of, I think, balancing things, and that comes from World War II and the choices that we made, the late hour in which we entered the war, and of course the horrible holocausts that took place in Europe and in Asia. You know, the phrase "never again" is one that sort of echoes from that time, and so there are people who look at Syria through that lens as well. And so I think that both of them are valid. One is definitely fresher, and I really can't read about this or see anything on television about this without being reminded of Iraq and how, and it's just so eerie and ironic to hear almost, you know, the same phrases so often. But so I encourage you to call in about that. And since this show wasn't promoted anywhere, I'm not gonna stay on for long unless you guys do call in, and you know, once you call in, and here's a number, 646-929-2495. Once you call in, then you have to hit one in order to get on the air. So I see some people have called in and are listening, but you have to hit one if you want to say something, and somebody has. Okay, 724 area code. You're on the middle ground with Eric Weiler on Coffee Party Radio. Tell us your name, where you're calling from, what's on your mind.
Hi, Eric. It's Greg in Pittsburgh. I'm glad I get a chance to talk to you tonight and share some thoughts about what's happening with Syria. I think I'm very much on the same page with you, and that is that as this crisis, I guess we could call it, developed, it started to just seem to me to be very much a replay of a desire for us to intervene in a foreign country. Although I think the thing that struck me as being somewhat different this time around was that it didn't seem to be attached to, I guess, what most people would consider to be our vital national interests vis-a-vis oil. And I don't know what your thoughts might be on this, but, you know, I don't want to call it an excuse either, but maybe one of the something I was willing to concede at least a little bit on this particular potential adventure was this notion that the use of gas would somehow be a line that couldn't be crossed. Although I don't know why so many other deaths seem to be okay, but it's the means by which those people get killed suddenly we get upset about or want to do something about.
Mm-hmm.
But there doesn't seem to be that national interest in terms of a natural resource, although there is, I think, a national interest in terms of allies in the region. And maybe that has a lot to do with perhaps our desire to do something to stop the carnage that is, you know, essentially a civil war. It is a civil uprising. I mean, it is how it got started. So I don't know if you've looked at it perhaps from that angle. If you have any thoughts about it in that respect, I don't think we should go. I don't think we should be there. I wonder what the alternatives are, short of trying to mediate a solution. And I kind of think back to the approaches that Carter took, you know, when it came to Egypt and Israel, that, you know, at least on some level seemed to have worked.
Well, as Chris Matthews said on his show Hardball recently, negotiating a settlement to the crisis is hard because for Assad, he'll probably be killed, if he's no longer in power.
It does seem to be his only way out. I'm sorry. I cut you off. I said it does seem to be his only way out. He's already crossed so many lines. I can't imagine any country giving him shelter, and there doesn't seem to be any other way for him to leave office except the same way that Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi left office.
Yeah. As far as why chemical weapons are different, really it has to do with another ghost, which is the way we ended World War II with the atomic weapons. And the fact that, you know, people in this country have never really been confronted with the reality of that, the reasons why we did it, and the images that, you know, resulted from it. You know, we've seen images from other Holocausts that took place during that time, including ones in Asia that were perpetrated not by us, but by Japan. But I don't know how many people have ever seen images from what we did to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There were a couple of never agains that came from World War II, and one of them is really one that we haven't even fully come to terms with, because when we talk about weapons of mass destruction, the truth is we're the only country that's really annihilated a city, or two. But the difference is that in a civil war, and there have been many civil wars, where people use conventional weapons to kill each other off, the killing is slow. And with weapons of mass destruction, you can, you know, annihilate large numbers of people very quickly. And if we allow that to become something that happens as a matter of course during these kinds of conflicts, then not only is the human cost just unfathomably tragic and horrific, but it does begin to affect our own national security as well, which is, I know, the lens through which a lot of Americans look at it. So I don't know. I mean, the people that I have been seeing and meeting with of late, including people that have contacted me through coffee party channels, tend to be ones who really are opposed to all of this. And I don't know, maybe it's my military upbringing, or I'm not sure what it is, but I'm really trying to keep an open mind to it. And honestly, you know, my congressman is Jerry Connolly, and I don't know if what I would say to him on this. I'm still kind of processing and collecting information.
Yeah, I guess I started out somewhat in the middle on all this too, but I think I've finally fallen on the side of this decision that for us to get involved militarily just doesn't seem like the right thing to do based on what we should have learned, not just over the last 10 or 12 years, you know, just but maybe by virtue of our entire history of how our involvement, whatever the intentions and whatever the means in the beginning, you know, really haven't worked out really that well, maybe since World War II. And I think too often a lot of our foreign policy and a lot of our military thinking, I think, is still trapped in that kind of a mindset that there's some really evil bad guy with a different uniform on that we can easily pick out and we can easily take sides with allies on, that we can define battlefields and on some level contain those combat missions to those battlefields. And it just doesn't, most of that just doesn't seem to apply, especially in the last, maybe even going back to places like Korea and Vietnam, but most certainly what we've done in the last decade or so in the Middle East, at least not to me, it doesn't seem like there's anything even close to a World War II type of framework in which to try and understand or process any of this.
Are you saying that you reject the World War II reference that I made?
No, I don't. No, not necessarily. Not at all. Not at all. Mm-hmm. I think what I'm actually saying is that the notion of a clearly defined set of enemies and allies, and a clearly delineated identification of an enemy and a mission and a purpose doesn't exist. I don't disagree at all for one second that we are, without question, the only superpower of any type that has actually used weapons of mass destruction in the sense that we have obliterated entire cities. And those threats are real and they exist today. And they are in many more hands than they were in the, in the 40s when we were the only ones to have them. I think what I'm really trying to say is that I think we, like a lot of cultures, it seems, and especially America, we tend to fight the last war, not the one that's coming up. And to put Syria into the context of some sort of a military exercise or mission just doesn't seem like that's the approach. If we're really truly trying to find a way for Syria to find a peaceful solution, or even any solution, whether we launch cruise missiles from battleships or we actually put troops on the ground, I think that kind of a strategy for finding a solution is that World War II mentality that we need to try and evolve past. I don't see how that works. I just don't see how that works. Not in Syria, not in Afghanistan, not in Iran, not anywhere. There are no militaries crossing borders invading countries since Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. That was the last kind of time you could make that argument where somebody took their military, went across a border, invaded a country, and we came to the rescue. That was the last time, to my recollection, anything like that happened. So I don't know what we hope to accomplish if what we're going to do with Syria is pick a side. The side, by the way, based on what I've read so far, is actually the side more closely aligned and allied to Iran, and start bombing their enemies.
I'm not sure which one's more allied to Iran. The Assad regime, I think, is the one, right?
I actually thought it was the rebels, but I could be wrong about that. I'm not professing to be a Middle Eastern expert by any stretch. You know, hopefully somebody else listening will call in and educate us. But it seems to me that this is very much a civil war being perpetrated by two factions within the Muslim culture there, isn't it? I mean, that's really what's happening here. Is it this uprising is, from what I've read so far at least, sounds to me and looks to me like another Sunni Shiite kind of conflict. And I'm not even going to try and get this right because I usually get it wrong. But I think it's the Shiites who are aligned with Iran and Saudi Arabia, and it's there. They are supporting the rebel faction who is trying to oust Assad, who I believe is a Sunni. But here again, this is very confusing and not something that we get a lot of education on. I don't think, at least in terms of regular news channels, it seems.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the president's decision to have Congress vote to approve the military strike?
I'd like to say that I think that's the way that it should work, because I do think that I think the idea of giving the executive branch so much military capability was a mistake to begin with, or so much authority. And this ought not to be the sort of foreign policy tool that a president gets a 90-day mulligan on. You know, I think that's a really, really bad idea. And I don't care who's in the White House doing it. I don't want a president and an administration to feel like the branches of the military are at their disposal to try and either force their will or kind of move a foreign nation in a certain direction for whatever means, and to have again this kind of grace period by which they can execute that sort of an effort without anyone else's approval. I just think that's really a bad idea. So I guess the answer to your question is I'm glad he's gone to Congress. I think it's politically going to be pretty interesting to see how this actually ends up playing out, because there were a whole bunch of people that on both sides, but I think mostly on the right, who were opposed to the idea that Obama was going to do something like this unilaterally, forgetting recent history, of course. And now seem to be also asking the question, why is he bothering to ask Congress for permission? I mean, kind of trying to have it both ways. I think he did what he should have done, and that was go to Congress. Well, now, if Congress gives him the okay, it's going to be really interesting to see how things play out on the political stage, both for a Republican House and for him and the Democrats that support this. It really will be interesting.
Well, stay on with this, Greg. I'm going to go to another caller, and then I'll come back to hear what you think and see if you want to respond to whatever they have to say. 732 area code is the next one. I think I know who this is, but tell us, who are you? No, I think now I know who you are. Leland, is that you?
Yes, it is. This is Lee from Middletown, New Jersey, and thanks for taking my call. A couple of things. One is the period from, I guess it was Saturday when the president said he was seeking congressional approval, from that time until the Congress actually does vote on it, to some extent creates a peace zone, a ceasefire, I believe, for Assad. Certainly, if he were to do a chemical attack before the congressional vote, it would ensure the outcome of that. So I don't know whether this was part of the strategy or not, but I do think it gives that period of somewhat a moratorium on the use of weapons for that period of time. So that might be a benefit from this. What I want to say, though, the main point I want to make is I believe that we need to use this as an impetus to improve international law. When the president gave his talk on Saturday and said, why is this a national interest? Basically what he said is that breaching the international taboo on the use of chemical weapons is a threat to all nations, all peaceful nations, and that's our security interest. And there's certainly something to that. But there's a incongruity, there's a problem with international law. On the one hand, many countries have signed the prohibition on chemical weapons, but if that's true, what is the enforcement mechanism here? Why can't we, once there's good evidence that that's been breached, why can't we, and this sounds simplistic, but put a warrant out on the guy, he's now wanted internationally, and that there's some sort of a international police force, a military force, or procedure which brings him to justice. I don't know how all that stuff works. I only heard it mentioned, I actually mentioned it briefly last week, but I only heard it mentioned once on the news that I watched. But until that is, until there's a procedure there where countries said chemical warfare is a no-no, this has definitely been breached. So now internationally we take action and this is what it is. That I think is a solution here because as Greg pointed out, the military option is a quandary. Has anyone crossed borders? No. Why is it the United States? I don't know. A military outcome do we want? I don't know. So that's my point, is strengthen the international law on this, take the opportunity to do it, and maybe that can be a lasting legacy from here.
Okay, cool. Let me get Greg to respond to that. Greg, that's sort of a new, a better idea, I think. I mean, when I first hear it, that instead of using fighter jets to bomb military targets in Syria, what if they go to the Hague when the International Court on War Crimes and basically convict the guy, and I don't know. Well, I guess the next step would be you send in this international force, not to occupy or bomb, but to get this one person.
That was kind of going to be my reaction to that. I think it's a tremendous idea if it could be something that could be pursued in what you might call on legal grounds. The hard part here would be how do you bring the perpetrator to justice, and if there's still such a large portion of the population in Syria, and if Assad still controls the military to a large extent, I don't think he's going to turn himself in, and I don't think apprehension is going to be something that is accomplished without an invasion and without an invading force. I don't pretend to know what the best approach or the right possibilities in any of this might be. But it does seem, though, that one of the things that hasn't been tried is to bring parties to the table to talk. I realize that that's not an easy proposition, that it might not even ever get to first base. And it's completely possible that I missed it and it was tried and failed. I mean, I don't know. But and I don't know who the other side is. I mean, you know, everybody talks about Assad, but you know, who are his peer leaders in the uprising? I mean, I don't even know if that's something that's identified or identifiable. But you know, what has not occurred in any of this, and maybe that it's. Maybe this horse is way out of the barn and it's just way even too late to even consider this, and that would be tragic. But I don't think a diplomatic solution was ever really attempted, it doesn't sound like it's even a consideration at this point. And I don't know clearly what Assad's reaction would be, but you know, has anybody asked him to just stop killing your citizens and let's see if we can't figure this out? On some other level, other than, you eventually leaving office in a box, because that's how it's going to happen. That's the only way it's going to happen if we don't try something else.
Yeah, a couple things on that. I don't know. Once you got a warrant out for his arrest on international law, I don't know how it would happen. I know a little bit about how it happens, domestically with police, which is that if you can have a warrant out for the arrest and you can take the person peaceably, you do that. But that there's some orderly escalation of more and more aggressive techniques until, it might be a shootout or something like that is what would happen domestically. But at least there's a legal – at least – if the international law gave a clear legal path, there's a warrant out for your arrest, we're calling for your arrest, we're calling for you to surrender, we're going to come to your door and knock on the door, and then we're going to beat the door down, something like that. At least it gives a path. I do want to mention an idea I got actually last Wednesday after last week's show, and I posted it as a comment here. And sometimes I think this is brilliant, and sometimes I think it's silly, but let me throw it out here. The idea is this. You take a B-2 bomber, and you fly it over the presidential palace in Syria, and you open the bomb bay doors. And what drops out of the bomb bay doors is humanitarian materials. It might be flowers, it might be food, it might be gas masks, it might be copies of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but it's certainly a poster that says, in big, bold letters, we are a peace-loving people, but our patience is limited. If you did something like that, he might not get the joke, or he might not get the point of it. But it demonstrates, number one, that we have the military capability to completely wipe him off the face of the earth. And that could have been done if the B-2 had been armed with other things. It would probably make headlines, and it would be talk around the town. And to Greg's point about this thing, how's this thing going to end? It's either with you in a box or something else happens, and it might get things talking. So I don't know if it's a silly idea or it's a brilliant idea, but I thought I had some fun with that.
That would be kind of interesting to see how the rest of the world would react to something like that. It certainly would be different, and then maybe on some level would create another opportunity for dialogue. I suspect not, but it would be a lot cheaper, and no one would get killed. The only thing that usually stands in the way of something like that, I suspect, is the pride and arrogance of the office of the presidency of the United States being, considered maybe as not serious about the situation. And that seems to be a complaint that is hurled at President Obama a little more than with others when he shows up places in shirt sleeves and gets accused of playing basketball and things like that. So I don't know if he's gonna drop flowers out of a bomber or not.
Well, I think that if we were to decide that he has to be brought to justice, it would require basically people soldiers infiltrating the country and finding out where he is. I don't think he's in the palace. I think he's probably hiding right now. So there would have to be a hunt.
I got to say, I'm sorry, go ahead, Aaron.
That's fine, go ahead.
The thought just occurred to me as we were talking about this idea of moving through a criminal prosecution because of a violation of international law. The thought that jumped into my head was that's really not how we operate anymore. We're not interested in actually pursuing what we like to characterize in our, in our comic book way, bad guys, via the courts. We didn't do it with Osama bin Laden. We didn't do it with Saddam Hussein. We didn't do it with Muammar Gaddafi. I don't think we're actually interested in the idea of the time and effort it would take to take and put Assad through any kind of criminal justice system, whether it's ours or an international one. That doesn't seem to actually be the way we do things anymore. It's a lot easier to drop a bomb on his palace,
mm-hmm.
and then beat our chests about how we took out the bad guy and how tough we are on terrorists and how tough we are on people who don't do things like we like them to want them to be done.
Has blowback. All of that has terrible blowback.
Absolutely, it does. We're suffering through that now. I think on a lot of levels, and this is heresy in a lot of quarters, but you can trace back the way we have conducted ourselves, especially on the international stage, and especially when it comes to foreign policy and interventions. You can trace so much of that right to 9/11, and we haven't done ourselves too many favors, I don't think, in the way we are still conducting a military-based foreign policy, when villagers in Somalia hear the whir of a drone overhead and wonder if they're going to get killed.
Yeah.
I don't know if going into Syria, I think it only exacerbates this whole issue. And David Brooks, a guy I only tend to agree with probably 30% of the time, wrote a great piece about this. That this could be the start of one big war. I think that was the title of his article. One big war in the Middle East, because when you take a step back and you look at what ostensibly our interests are in a civil war in Syria, it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier. It's hard to pin anything on it except this blustering kind of line in the sand that Obama drew on chemical weapons, and now that Assad has stepped over it, this notion that our credibility and the credibility of our threats is diminished or eliminated if, in fact, now we don't go and do something. So, yeah, fault the president for making that kind of a binary sort of threat and statement, saying, if you do this, then I'll do that. Well, this got done. Now the question is, will he do that? And if he doesn't, what are the repercussions there? Supposedly, the hawks will say that, the rest of the world, like North Korea, will be emboldened and, launch a nuclear strike on South Korea because we drew a line in the sand and didn't do anything about it with Assad. Whether or not that's a legitimate and logical argument, I'm not smart enough to answer that question. But we got ourselves into this situation because I think, frankly, our foreign policy has become one of bomb first, ask questions later.
Okay. I'm going to throw out another question in a second. Let me just give the number one more time. Hopefully we can hear from one more person before we end the show. We'll end it at the top of the hour in 18 minutes. Okay. It's 646-929-2495 to get on the Middle Ground Radio Show and Coffee Party Internet Radio Network. Here's a new question. We're on with Greg and Lee. Greg from Pennsylvania, Lee from New Jersey. Do you think that when Obama made that declaration, the line in the sand statement, that he expected that Assad would use chemical weapons and therefore give him the, I guess you could say, basically give him an excuse to get involved and that he wanted to be involved for humanitarian reasons even before chemical weapons or for some other reason? Or do you think that he thought that by making that statement, it would be, it would make it very unlikely that the weapons would be used? I'll go to Lee first.
Yeah, I take option B on that. There's always been rumors about Pearl Harbor, and did the president know that the Pearl Harbor attack was going to happen, and did he let it happen, and did he do it as an excuse to go into the war? I haven't studied that in depth, but I kind of think no. I think that our president not only won a Nobel Peace Prize, but I think he's a peace-loving person. I think he said that a year ago because he felt it would be an important deterrent to Assad, because it goes on the record as saying that we are watching you. We do not want chemical weapons to occur. Did he think through everything that would happen if the line was crossed? He's a very smart guy. He's a very strategic guy. But you can only look so far ahead. Greg had characterized it as binary. If you do this, I'll do that. I think it was a little more nuanced than that. First off, this part was something about systemic use of chemical weapons, not the smaller ones. So he couched it that way. And that was unspecified. It was something like, we will hold you accountable. And it wasn't clear whether that necessarily meant some direct military action or some other consequence, whatever that might have been. But I go with that the president made that statement as his way of putting Assad on notice that we're watching, that this is a line you please do not cross, and that I don't think it was there to give an excuse to go in. But I can't read his mind.
What do you think, Greg?
I tend to think the same thing, that I think it was meant to put Assad on notice. I do want to believe that it was not something that he threw out there, cavalierly and without a lot of thought, and that, things were thought through in terms of this perhaps being that, that lever point by which perhaps things would tilt back towards the idea of a scaling back and a more peaceful solution. But there was none of the follow-up. There wasn't anything else that was being done except, okay, we're watching, don't do this, or we'll do, and to Lee's point, it wasn't very specific, it was nuanced. That is kind of how those guys in politics tend to work. They're not going to put themselves completely into a corner. And who knows? Perhaps on some level, he had planned all along for this to be challenged by the Republicans, for it to go to Congress, and then to be able to assure the American public that, hey, look, this is I'm not doing it the way my predecessor did. I'm doing it, presumably the right way at this point. He didn't do it that way at first to keep his party happy, and now the dirt on the hands will be shared by everyone, from Boehner and McConnell to Nancy Pelosi. They're all behind this idea of, I won't say going into Syria, but I think as of today, I just heard that they're all in support of taking some sort of affirmative military action to do what? That's the question, right? To do what? At this point, it seems like it's only to send a message. We said we were going to do something, so now we're doing something. It just doesn't seem like this doesn't seem like a path to de-escalation. It only seems like a path to escalation.
Just on that, I'm sorry, just quickly on that, Greg. I think that the cruise missiles could take out military assets of Assad, and I don't know how quickly they could be replenished and so on. So if he, he's been flying helicopters, he's been flying fighter planes and these kinds of things. He used rockets to send chemical weapons. If those military assets can be destroyed without collateral damage by cruise missiles, that could be a de-escalation. I don't know. You rarely see that kind of a thing. It's normally, I smack you and you smack me harder kind of a thing. But maybe there is something that could be done that would actually lead to a de-escalation.
Well, and I hope you're right. One of the articles I read recently, though, led me to believe that Assad isn't leaving things like chemical weapons, you know, out in the open. We number one, we can't be absolutely certain about where any of these targets might be. As good as satellite intelligence and other intelligence sources might be, you know, until and I think the point this article was making, until somebody lasers a target, you can't be absolutely sure. And if these munitions, if the intent is to take chemical weapons out of his hands, they are, again, likely stored in hardened facilities that a cruise missile actually can't penetrate, won't actually even do very much damage on. It takes those kinds of bunker-busting, very large weapons that ultimately are going to create a fair amount of collateral damage. And this article finally made the point that blowing up chemical weapons actually doesn't blow up chemical weapons. It will do damage to the delivery mechanisms, but the only way you get rid of chemical weapons is actually through extremely high temperature incineration. That requires those assets to be gathered up and disposed of in very proper, scientifically controlled kinds of ways. Dropping a bomb on them, to your point, will do wondrous things for spreading it around.
Yeah.
So the cruise missiles, when they get launched, what I hope, and I suspect that these people are obviously a lot smarter than I am, they thought all this out, and what they really ought to be doing is focusing on what they did with Iraq, and that is the command and control center, so that you kind of immobilize, make blind, deaf, and dumb the command centers of the military so that they cannot execute their battle plans against their citizens. The conclusion I came to reading this article is what we almost certainly will not be able to do is disarm Assad of his chemical weapons if all we're doing is sending cruise missiles and dropping bombs. It just won't work. It doesn't work that way.
I think that you're right. What will happen is they will take out the airfields and the military centers, and it will be this is the punishment. And that would make it easier to set up a no-fly zone, which would be, I guess, the next response if they decide they have to punish him again. As far as the president's decision, first of all, the first statement that he made, the ultimatum or whatever, my impression was that he walked into the White House and a system, a sort of a war machine, where there are generals and war profiteers and, you know, military think tanks and everything that try to pressure the president toward wars. And I think that the concentration of power into the president has made it a lot easier for those interests to get the wars that they need, they want. And that I remember so many historians, like presidential historians, have said that the expansion of presidential power never goes the other way. It always expands. No president will ever say, actually, no, I don't want to have that power. They'll always try to get more.
Right.
And the interesting thing was that then when the president made the statement, and mind you, I'm making a film and I'm spending like 99% of my waking hours working on this film, but from what I heard, it's very interesting sitting in Selma, Alabama with this group of mostly African Americans looking at the president's remarks. But what I heard was he said, I still do have the power to make this decision myself, but I want for the American people to have their say through their representatives in Congress. And what I really like about that is that, as I said before, it does set a new precedent where there are two choices the president has. The president isn't pinned against the wall by the the war industry and those generals and those think tanks who always want the next war, he can always go to the American people, you know, the way that the Constitution was originally designed. And so this president and future presidents will have that choice. So I think that's a very good precedent. And then the other thing is that I think that actually I'm just getting distracted because my house is being invaded. Let you respond to that. Go ahead, Lee.
Yeah, I do believe that waiting for congressional approval is a very good move. He was kind of out there alone. He doesn't have necessarily the backing of international law. We saw what happened in Great Britain. He'd gotten several letters from Congress saying, you want to look at our, you know, please ask for our approval. The popular approval on that was low, so I think it was a very important thing to do, and it has the effects that Eric talked about. I do. I want to make actually, and this is relevant, I want to recommend a movie. Perhaps my favorite movie of all times is a movie called 13 Days. It's a docudrama, not a documentary, but it's a docudrama about the 13 days back in October 1962 when the Cuban Missile Crisis unfolded. And what it shows is the creative thinking, the creative options that were explored that led to a basically peaceful resolution of that. A lot of creative thinking in there, and it was a good outcome. I think it's a fascinating movie. It's historically fairly accurate. Stars Kevin Costner, who plays a minor person who didn't have that big a role, but the major events are in there. And I think that that can help us think through the false dichotomies. Eric posed a question to me last week, you know, do you think it can all be done with diplomatic? You don't isolate it that way. You always want to integrate all of your assets, the State Department, the Defense Department, the military assets, the international options that we have, whatever dialogue we might have and so on. So I recommend that movie, 13 Days. Watch it while we're waiting to see what happens next in Syria.
When things like this occur and people like us talk about...
We do have some new callers. Let me bring them in before...
Terrific.
Okay, cool. Let's go to 313 area code. Go ahead.
I was just mainly interested in hearing more about the effectiveness of the targets that could be chosen and why they would have any real meaning.
Lee, you seem to know the most about that.
I believe, or I like to believe, that we have good intelligence. We have spy satellites, we have YouTube spy planes, and I think we have to believe now that we have had video drones overhead for a long time. In addition, there may well be special forces in the country at this time. I don't know that. And there might be intelligent assets, and we have allies in Jordan, in Turkey, in Israel, and perhaps other countries in the area. So what I'm bringing out is that we may well have excellent intelligence, which would give us a broad choice of targets. I don't know what they all are. You can talk about his things like the presidential palace or his vacation home or military assets, whatever fighter jets he might have, whatever air bases they might have. Greg had talked about the command and control positions that they have. Yes, hitting the chemical weapons themselves is not a good thing, but they need rockets to deliver them, and wherever they are, they might be there. So I think there's a broad choice of those targets, and maybe there's a lot of good thought going into some sort of a sequence of step one. By the way, is you announce to Assad, we have congressional approval, we have massive weapons. We would like you to resign. And if you need an exile country, you know, come here. But at least it's a way out. So you do that. If he ignores that, you hit some number of targets and you repeat the offer. And it just might be some way to escalate that in some linear fashion where you kind of do, you know, are you listening now? Are you listening now? Are you listening now? with increasingly significant military hits, which are chosen to diminish his interests and minimum human damage. My speculation.
What are the chances of the citizenry being used as human shields?
Probably pretty good.
How much are we?
But I don't think. But I don't think you can do it for all of the assets. So I think that some assets will be protected that way, and that creates a terrible dilemma. But I think there will be assets that he cares about that probably are not protected that way. But again, I don't have any intelligence on this, other than I do pay attention to it. I mentioned last week my daughter's an Air Force pilot, but we don't talk about these kinds of things, but at least it gives me some interest in following these issues.
I have a daughter in the Air Force, too. Not a
yes.
pilot, but I understand the concern.
Yeah.
This is Greg. I would just like to add to what Lee was saying, and especially when it comes to what we so euphemistically refer to as collateral damage. It's inconceivable that that's going to be zero. No matter how precise our intelligence, no matter how precise our armaments and our tactics, innocent people will get killed.
I think that will be Assad's intention, I'm sure.
Absolutely, and that was Saddam Hussein's intention. That's these guys that are dictators who have essentially lost their minds. I mean, I can't imagine at least how the word sane could be described to be used to describe Assad's thinking any longer. I mean, the guy has gone crazy if what he's doing is killing tens of thousands of his citizens. Regardless of what they would like to have happen, would have liked to have seen changed 2 years ago. But if we start launching an attack on his assets, on Assad's assets, there is absolutely no doubt people are going to be killed as a result of it. And whether that person is an innocent civilian or a general, they are still a person. They are still a person with a family. They've got people who are not going to be happy about that. And, you know, we're just going to, I think, be taking one more step backwards in terms of our whole relationship with the entire Middle East. I just don't see how any of this comes out working for us on any level. We've already made this mistake terribly, I think, twice. We should not be making it again.
Okay.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Eric.
313, Eric, we didn't get your name.
Bob Whitney from Milwaukee.
Okay, hey, Bob, thanks for calling. Did you want to get a last thought in or question or comment?
Yes.
We're going to start looking down the show.
Well, the only thing I'd be interested in knowing, given the asymmetric relationship that Israel has with the entire Middle East, I'm wondering what that card is going to have to do. I mean, are we going to play a tool for Israel, or are they going to be a tool for us? I mean, what's the Israeli input here as far as their participation in this whole fracas?
Well, this is Greg. I'll answer first by saying I have no idea, except to say that Israel shares a border with Syria, and you can and I will tell you this. I would take money to the bank that if we start launching armaments into Syria, you know which direction Syria is going to launch their armaments. You know it's going to happen.
And then when they do.
Exactly. There you go, brother. There you go. Somebody in D.C. has to have thought this out. Lee, you were talking about earlier how they plan strategies. I envision people in rooms with decision trees and really sophisticated thought modeling and everything else trying to take all these permutations into account. The four of us aren't the first ones to figure this out.
Yeah, I certainly hope that goes on.
They know precisely what possibilities exist.
What are you hoping to go on, please?
Me personally,
the detailed strategic. the detailed strategic analysis.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. That's what's happening. Yes, the immensely complex detailed analysis that goes on with all the possible permutations has to account for what happens vis-a-vis Israel if we launch and if we don't.
Well, I must
and it
that,
has to follow I, through to how does it end?
Yeah. Oh. How does it end?
Not well.
No, I mean, as a matter of fact, it sort of would be the Armageddon of the nuclear holocaust in the Middle East, and then we can just wait for the cloud to circle the planet for millennia.
Well, there aren't too many folks over there that presumably have those armaments, but they can do a whole lot of damage, and it's not inconceivable that the escalation could go in that direction. There's a whole lot of weapons being pointed in a whole lot of directions over there, and I would hate for us to be the match that lights the fuse.
Yeah.
If we haven't already.
Wow. Anybody
if we haven't
know,
already.
What, that's a good question. Can an individual, a citizen, adequately express their concern and reservations with regards to what's going down? I mean, does it matter that I contact my congressperson, that I contact my senator? You know, I mean, it seems like it's completely out of our hands.
It's Bill, right?
Bob.
This is Greg. All I can answer, the only way I can answer that question is I feel like I have done that. It's my responsibility to do that. Whether it makes a difference or not is out of my hands. But I won't stay silent. I won't stay quiet.
You know, I think that the president's decision to refer this to Congress and thus to the American people through Congress is going to make that more likely. The situation we had was really wrong. It was really bad. So the only person who can be held accountable is really the president. And Congress can say what they want, but they have no agency. And so the people have one vote every 4 years, and in the case of a president who's already been reelected, there really isn't a way to directly respond to this decision. So this way, we have every member of Congress on record on this war. And
I like that.
Yeah, I think that if they vote for the war, or they vote for the military strike that leads to the war and all the horrific things you guys just mentioned, I think that members of Congress may lose their seats. And, you know, if it happens that these kinds of matters are referred to the American people, I know that there can be pitfalls there, because all of the war propaganda we saw leading up to Iraq probably could have gotten the American people to vote, whether it was a referendum or contacting their members of Congress, because unfortunately they think that entertainment is news. But it's something we haven't tried in a while, and I think more accountability and in trusting the American people to self-govern is the right direction to go.
Eric, it's Greg. I know you want to wrap this up, but I'd like to add something to what you just said. And again, I'm being a bit of a cynic, I guess, tonight, and that is that while I make sure that my elected officials know how I feel, especially on really important issues like this one, I just did a quick search. Washington Post just published a poll today. 60% overall oppose missile strikes. The opposition is about equal between Democrats and Republicans. It's actually above 60% with independents. Now, here's the punchline. Congress is supporting the president's move because, in spite of our opposition as a populace, we still don't have enough impact on their elections and their reelections. It goes right back to the big money in politics, which is the
you
big fight that we need to keep fighting.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, money is an important thing, but if we end up lighting the fuse that leads to some kind of horrific war, because Congress goes against the will of the American people, I think that those members of Congress will be held accountable, regardless of how much political advertising that the richest, you know, 16 families in the United States purchase for them.
And I would like to agree. I would like to agree, which is why I continue to support the efforts of the Coffee Party and a couple of other movements to get money out of politics. That ultimately and finally, if things, and it's sad that it has to be that tragic, if the American population is actually going to go to the polls in big numbers, and despite the gerrymandering of districts, not vote for people or reelect people who, you know, think that. You know, the branches of the military are just an extension of a president's responsibilities for executing foreign policy. And mm-hmm. Let's hope that that's what happens. But that'll happen almost undeniably from a grassroots up perspective, because we'll be fighting the overwhelming barrage of messaging that gets paid for by all that big money that. It, from an industrial, a military-industrial complex, has everything to gain and nothing to lose when it comes to our adventures overseas.
Well, I think this is going to be bigger than any party politics type of, you know, the fact that, you know, the poll you just cited, the opposition to the military strike is, you know, crosses all party lines. I just think that people are not going to be willing to be blinded by partisanship or by political advertising when they cast the next ballot. And if it does end up to be a catastrophe, I think that the way people voted on this could be a huge part of the election, depending on when the catastrophe becomes clear, because it doesn't always become clear as soon as the bomb drops that it's a catastrophe. Sometimes it looks better at the outset, as we saw with Iraq. Not that it looked good at the outset, but it looked better than it ended up looking 10 years later. Okay, we do want to wrap it up. I'm going to give Lee a chance to do one last comment before we go. Lee, closing thoughts?
I think it would be a shame to not take this opportunity to strengthen the path through international law. I don't know whether that's being explored now. We don't hear a lot about it. I don't know how well that works. But our first thought should be, can this be solved through international law, as opposed to our first thought being president goes in there without other approvals.
All right.
So that could be something good that comes out.
Well, thank you to Bob in Milwaukee, Lee, as always, Lee Beaumont from, where is it in New Jersey?
Middletown,
New Jersey. And Greg, you're in Pittsburgh, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, and Greg in Pittsburgh. It's been an interesting conversation. I learned a lot, not enough to know exactly how I feel about it, but I think that taking a cautious approach to these important matters is the right approach, and you know, and I think that that is what is developing historically in this moment in our country, and that is probably, I think it's certainly preferable to the way things had been drifting in the past few decades. So let's see if we're right. Let's see what happens, and we'll continue the conversation in a week. Thanks very much for listening, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.